I think going through this and almost dying and almost losing your business that was doing, you know, $90 million in revenue, that is going to cause you to change some things. And it's going to cause you to really double down and try to make sure you're running this, because you know that it can be gone in an instant.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, and I'm joined by
Aaron Allpeter.
Aaron, what's going on? How's your day going? We've got a pretty exciting episode today with True Classic Tees, which, you know, I think gets a lot of hype on the kind of e-commerce Twitter world. What do you think?
You know, I wish I was wearing a True Classic Tee, but my order hasn't shown up yet. So I think I'll dig into that a little bit later, but so far, love what I'm reading about them.
Well, I've got to start because I know we usually cover current events and news, but I had a bit of a rough morning. I, first thing in the morning, fell victim to a ticket scam. I was trying to buy tickets to see Matt Rife, who's a comedian that I enjoy.
Yeah,
and he's in Salt Lake City here April 4th. So I go on Facebook. I don't know why, I just like search the marketplace first thing, Matt Rife tickets, you know, some lady selling them for like a fair price, which is kind of the, like, it was the normal price that they're being sold for on like Vivid Seats or Ticketmaster or whatever. And I'm thinking like, all right, well, same price, but I'll avoid the fees going through, you know, Ticketmaster. So I messaged this lady who, like, her profile is in Utah. She has kids on her profile, like looks like a completely legitimate Facebook profile. I message her. I'm like, hey, do you still have these like Matt Rife tickets? And she's like, yeah, of course. And then, you know, we message back and forth a little bit. She sends me a screenshot of the tickets with her name on the tickets too in the screenshot. And like, I don't know if she edited it or what, but long story short, you know, at first she's like, hey, you know, let's use Apple Pay. And then she's like, oh, let's use PayPal. And then she's like, my friends say, like, use friends and family on PayPal so you don't have to pay fees and stuff. So, of course, me, first thing in the morning, thinking, oh, you know, nice, like, Utah mother just, like, you know, selling these tickets at a fair price. Sure enough, I send the money. And, you know, at first she says, oh, yeah, I'm logging in my Ticketmaster account, going to send the tickets. And then, like, I follow up, hey, what's going on? I can't send the message. I've been blocked. And, yeah, I opened a case of PayPal. But, you know, friends and family, I don't think you get that money back on PayPal. And like, it was honestly crazy to me how well set up this scam was, because literally, like, I don't know how they got access to this lady's profile on Facebook, but it looked so legit from Utah as well. So that's number one. So they have, you know, a targeted Facebook account. Number two, they have a screenshot of the tickets that I wanted, Matt Rife, with her name on them. So that's number two. And I mean, number three, they kind of, like, the English in Facebook Messenger that she was sending me was perfect. And the account that I ended up sending it to kind of, like, ended up having a Vietnamese name, which, like, as soon as I sent the money, I basically knew I got scammed. I was like, oh, my gosh, you got to be kidding me. And, yeah, that's that. I mean, don't transact first thing in the morning is my big takeaway.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Watch out for the scamming Utah mothers. I mean, the worst, so Facebook Messenger, I think you probably deserve a little bit of that. You know, the only thing worse would have been, like, let me search on Temu for some Matt Rife tickets. Yeah. But, like, I totally, like, the not thinking well. It reminds me of a story when I was working at the Lipton Tea Factory. I'd just gotten off of, like, an 18-hour shift. And I get home and I get a phone call. And it's one of those extended warranty people. And, you know, like, whatever, I picked it up. I was craving some personal attention. And this person was just like, hey, you know, I want to talk to you about this, like, extended warranty thing. You should sign up for it. I'm like, yeah, sure. And then I hang up and my wife's like, hey, how you doing? And I was like, I think I just did something really dumb. And she's like, what? Uh-huh. I was like, walk through and, you know, we signed up for some stupid thing that we were able to get canceled eventually. But I hope you get your money back.
Yeah, I don't think I will, unfortunately. So, you know, if you go on Twitter, you'll see my tweet about it. Tag my Matt Rife. Because hopefully he'll see it, and then maybe I'll get, like, free tickets, because now I'll have paid, like, 2x for tickets. But it is what it is. That's how it goes. What was catching your eye this past week? I know you've got some articles that you put here in the notes. I'm curious what caught your eye.
Yeah, so kind of three things. It was kind of a busy week. The first one is that Australia is getting rid of about 500 tariffs. So I just thought it was interesting because it represents about 14% of the total tariff revenue that they're bringing in. And, you know, last week we talked about Temu and how 321 is probably going to get closed in the U.S. because of these loopholes. And so we're talking about adding barriers and making it more difficult to ship things cross-border. And here Australia is doing the exact opposite. And, you know, I was trying to think through, okay, why might this be? And, you know, part of it is these tariffs are blocking things like washing machines or apparel or things like that. I think the Australian government has looked at this and said, you know what, we're probably never going to be the best at producing washing machines, nor do we think this is a strategic thing. And so really, we're just hurting our consumer, our people. So we're going to get rid of these sorts of things. And then on the other hand, it's like their biggest trading partner is China. And I would imagine that a good chunk of these products coming in are of that origin. And so it's an interesting piece where, you know, maybe there's some other deal going on where they're trying to smooth over some relations. I know it's been a little bit rocky with some things that US and Australia have done recently. And it's just, I love the intersection between geopolitics and kind of supply chain.
Yeah, that's a good tidbit. I mean, only if America saw that in some ways and didn't realize that, you know, putting tariffs on our products being imported actually impacted, you know, businesses here for the most part and made us pay more for products that we were trying to bring in. But that's pretty cool. I also saw, was it Allbirds got a new CEO because they just have not been performing in the public markets?
Yeah, that's right. So they had two co-CEOs when they were private. One of them gave up that title a few years ago and is basically leading product. And they had Joey Zwillinger, who was their sole CEO as a founder. He's stepping down. Basically, they were valued at $1.2, $1.6 billion, something like that. And now they're only worth just over $100 million after they went public. And they're still losing money. And I think it's a really interesting kind of case study in where we are from a D2C point of view. The person who's taking over is a COO who came from the outside. He's only been with Allbirds for a few years. And his expertise, his background is really in turnarounds and aggressive cost cutting, aggressive moves toward profitability. And you look about what Allbirds stood for, and it was all about sustainability. It was all about, you know, those sorts of things. That's what's been front and center in their product and their marketing as why their business exists. And it almost feels like the board and the market are repudiating it a little bit and basically saying, that's nice. It's still important, but it's not the most important thing. And so we're going to double down and try to run this as a proper shoe company, so to speak.
Yeah, they definitely need a turnaround. I mean, they're not performing well in the public markets. They're losing a lot of money and their revenue is declining. So hopefully they're able to pull it off. I mean, we definitely want to see them continue to win. And, you know, I was an early customer. I like Allbirds shoes, and I think they've iterated quite a bit on the product, but we'll see where that goes. Another note here that I think is interesting, because we did cover Temu just last week or the week prior, is that Family Dollar is set to close 1,000 stores. Do you think that is impacted because of Temu? I mean, what kind of effects does Temu have on these dollar stores?
Yes. So it's Dollar Tree is the head company that owns that part. But basically, we talked about how Temu is basically taking a huge chunk of the dollar market. And so I think that this is just, if not a coincidence, a very direct result of the fact that Temu is coming in and competing. Although to be fair, Family Dollar and Dollar Tree have had a rough merger. And I believe Dollar Tree has like 16,000 locations. So, you know, they're shedding 1,000. That's a big headline. They still have 15,000 more. So a little bit of a mixed bag there.
Yeah. I also saw that Outdoor Voices is closing all of its retail stores, which I think is a bit different than, you know, where most e-commerce brands or traditional D2C brands are heading, right? Like, we've seen most e-commerce brands in this market try to expand into retail, and Outdoor Voices is actually closing stores. I think it's more so around cost cutting and trying to lower their overhead rather than, like, you know, is this performing or not? I think it was just a measure to right the ship. I mean, Outdoor Voices has struggled over the years, and some people have, you know, pointed to them, you know, potentially just, you know, not being efficient with their cash. And so I think this kind of goes to show, you know, they're trying to be more efficient and lower their overhead. The other cool story I saw was Peter Rahal, who started RX Bar and had a big exit with RX Bar, is kind of taking another swing at bat, maybe even bigger this time with a new protein bar that he's launching later this year called David. And I think what really caught my eye is I think most founders, when they, you know, are in an industry or have success in an industry, they then go try to start a company in another industry. And Peter like has doubled down on, you know, this kind of protein bar brand that he's now launching. And so I think it's just like really interesting from a founder perspective to see this founder that's, you know, sold his brand for hundreds of millions of dollars to now go and start another different type of bar, but a protein bar in this industry. And I don't know about their branding, like the David branding that they they're like proposing on his Twitter, at least is it's interesting. I mean, for me, I would probably go with a brand that caters to both, you know, male and female, but you know, they're really, I think, honing in on this niche of, you know, men that want a high quality protein bar that, you know, maybe are a bodybuilder or something of that nature that just want, you know, a quick bar that gives them high quality protein. But it's interesting. I mean, he's doubled down on, you know, launching a new brand of bars.
Yeah, you know, it's not a bad idea. You just kind of wait for that non-compete to expire, and then you already have the connections. Investors will see this as a sure thing, and you just kind of rinse and repeat. So if that's what you want to do, that seems like a great framework.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, let's start with True Classic Teas. So I think we're going to tee this off with kind of the background on the founders. It is just a really amazing and interesting story to understand how True Classic got to the scale that they're at today. I mean, let's start with the founders here. I can give, you know, a deep dive on Ryan Bartlett, I think is how you pronounce his name. It's B-A-R-T-L-E-T-T. I don't know if you pronounce that T in the middle or not. So is it Bartlett or Bartlett? I'm not quite sure, but that's how we'll say it. So Ryan grew up in Michigan. His dream was becoming the next Dr. Dre. He spent 8 years working as a musician and playing piano in bars. It doesn't seem like he had too much to show for it after those 8 years. And he started making money on the side, playing poker, eventually moving to Las Vegas and playing for 4 years in Vegas before going bust and going back to LA. And so, you know, he spent some time in kind of the music nightclub industry there before eventually getting a job in digital marketing and starting his own SEO agency called SEO Direct based in Los Angeles. And, you know, I think like it's interesting to see him kind of transpire from chasing his dream as a musician to playing poker to then, you know, getting into digital marketing and running this SEO agency, which is probably kind of that insight that led him to start True Classic Tea because he had digital marketing experience. And I think Ryan like knew he wanted to start a brand when he was at that digital marketing firm. He spent a lot of time learning, you know, email, SMS, brand marketing, all that fun stuff. And I think he really spent some time kind of studying different markets and realized that t-shirts had become a bit of a commodity and therefore figured it was like a race to the bottom from a fit and quality perspective and felt like the market was overlooked by incumbents, right? So he wanted to create like a premium product, which is interesting when it comes to timing, right? Because so there's like a lot of premium t-shirt brands in the industry right now, like Cuts Clothing, you know, there's just a lot that come to mind, like Built Basics, you know, there's a lot of brands kind of that seemed to have started at a similar time to True Classic. But, you know, he realized before he was going to launch that this was going to be a huge undertaking and he was going to need help. So he reached out to his family friend, Matt Winnick. And Matt comes from an investment banking background. So he is listed on LinkedIn as a co-founder of True Classic, but it's unclear how active he is in the day-to-day. I think his main contribution was that he connected Ryan with co-founder number three, who is Nick Ventura, and Nick's background is really in manufacturing and distribution. Do you want to talk a bit about who Nick is, Aaron, and how, you know, this founding team came to be?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, Nick is a supply chain guy, at least that's his kind of niche that he filled out in True Classic. But he graduated from the University of Arizona majoring in history. And so not classically trained in supply chain, but certainly has learned quite a bit. Once he graduated, he started a apparel company called Vinley with one of his fraternity brothers. And they really kind of grew a niche. They ran this from 2010 to 2020. And basically, they were a division of this group called Youth Monument Clothing. It's based in LA, and it's all about local. And so they've got vertically integrated operations that employ about 600 people today over a 16-block radius in downtown Los Angeles. And their business was really branded T-shirts for college athletics. And so, you know, be Bama, TCU, Arizona, USC, whatever you're looking for. And it's interesting because, you know, he ran this business for 10 years. And about year three, year four, actually started to gain some notoriety. They had toyed with the idea of producing in Mexico. They had thought it was going to be easier and cheaper, but they ended up, you know, having to commit to much larger MOQs than what they were used to, what they needed. And so their just inventory turns and their cash kind of went out the window. And so it was very difficult. And so he made some notoriety in 2013, 2014 as kind of a made in the USA sort of spokesman, one of these up and coming companies that was really focused on that. They, in their peak, were doing about 40,000 garments per month in LA. So a pretty decent sized company. And, you know, really, really much, he's a very kind of private guy, I get the sense, certainly compared to Ryan. But a lot of the press and things that he did were in 2013. I don't know if you remember, but there was a big fire in Bangladesh in 2012 that killed a lot of people. And, you know, he was one of the people that a lot of reporters would go to and kind of get his opinion on producing in the U.S. or nearshoring versus going overseas and chasing things that were shorter. And so anyway, so that was Nick's background. As you mentioned, he was put in contact with Ryan via Matt. And it seems like Ryan kind of basically knew that he was going to need someone who spoke supply chain or spoke factory at the very least. And so they had a phone call and they kind of hit it off. And basically the way Ryan tells the story is he gave away almost half the company on that phone call to get him on board. And, you know, kind of question I had is, as we were preparing, and just want to get your thoughts, Nathan, just how important is it to have a co-founder who can fill in your weak spots versus just having a contractor or employees that can fill in your weak spots?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I've been a solo founder for kind of most of my career, I would say. I think, like, if you can find the right person that you trust and that you have a longstanding relationship with, I think, you know, that's a great avenue to have a co-founder with. I think what is really overseen by a lot of people when they're starting a business is that, you know, a lot of companies die because co-founder relationships fall out, right? And so I think that's something to be aware of is, you know, I think one of the biggest reasons why companies fail is because co-founder disputes, right? And so I think that's kind of overseen. And a lot of times when you're going to raise capital from VCs, you know, typically they prefer you to have co-founders. But at the end of the day, that's also one of the biggest reasons why companies fail. And so a lot of co-founder breakups happen and sometimes they can be, you know, pretty ugly. So I think if you, you know, do have a co-founder, definitely make sure you have your operating agreement in place to, you know, understand every angle of, you know, all these what ifs that can occur in business, because you are really, you know, kind of marrying this person, if you will. And I think it's kind of overlooked by a lot of people when they're starting a business in terms of, you know, is this the right person for me? And do I know how I'm going to operate and grow with this person?
And that makes a ton of sense. And, you know, I think sometimes the skill set of a co-founder is different than what you need once you get into something. And that can be a very difficult thing to go as well. But I think back to all the different founders that I've worked with and know and respect. And for the ones that really made it work, they really, you know, knew each other and had an appreciation and respect for each other before they started the business. And so I think that that's what makes this story even more interesting is the fact that, you know, Ryan and Nick didn't have a previous relationship. And it was really a, hey, I'm doing this thing. Here's my idea. I need someone who speaks factory. Do you want to do it? Here's 40% or whatever it was of the company. To me, that just seems like a recipe for disaster. But as we'll find out, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think their story is pretty incredible. I mean, you know, so the idea really hatched in 2018. You know, they had built a small line of six colors in one SKU. So just, you know, a t-shirt with six colors basically, but they had a really nice fit, you know, high quality shirt. And they launched in September 2019, doing $26,000 in sales across 651 orders in their first month, which I think is pretty amazing. I mean, they spent like $3,000 to get those shirts, it sounds like. And you know, Ryan said I would spend $100 and make $300 in online sales. And then the next day he would spend $100 and make $400. So it seems like their kind of paid ad spend really worked from day one, which is surprising because, you know, most brands at this time were not reliant on paid acquisition, right? This is post iOS 14. And so tracking a lot of times has gotten messed up, but something really must have hit a chord with their audience. And they scaled up quickly. I mean, I don't know exactly how much revenue they did in their first year, 2019, but it was reported that in 2020, they did about $15 million. And so, I mean, I'm kind of curious, like from your perspective, do you think launching the year before COVID was like just perfect timing? Or, you know, do you think you could launch the same brand today? Like, what do you think about that timing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they felt that the timing was fine because nobody knew the pandemic was coming. And so there was enough that they saw that said, hey, this could be something. Now, did they know that it was going to be a business doing hundreds of millions of dollars revenue, or was it going to be a side business? They didn't know, but they're willing to test it out. And I think that even today, you could do it as well. We don't have to have a pandemic in order for e-commerce to do really well, right? But I think that, you know, one of the things that we keep going back to with True Classic is just how they built their business. And, you know, we'll get into this a little bit later, but they really have gained notoriety as kind of being an exemplary D2C company right now, really because their secret is, hey, let's grow profitably. And that is such a shock to the system for so many people that's this novel idea that's out there. And so, you know, if you and I were going to start a t-shirt company today, this is exactly what we would do as well. We would focus on growing more slowly than maybe we could have if we were willing to set money on fire. And we would, you know, try to make sure that it was always break even. And I love the way that Ryan broke it out, where it just says, look, I'm going to spend this amount of money, and as long as I'm getting more than what I spent, I get to keep going. And that's at a basic level, really what a business is about.
Yeah, 100%. I think too, I mean, their growth is pretty incredible in terms of how they were data driven with their ad spend. I mean, they don't really publicly talk about what they did in revenue in 2021, but it's estimated about $90 million, like 60,000 orders a month or so. But they also made like a near fatal mistake in 2021, which I think was like pretty insane because they're growing at just this incredible click, which is just amazing to see. But as you're growing at that rate, forecasting as we know it is so hard to do. And so they placed a purchase order worth $40 million of product to, you know, what they thought would be kind of their first of several orders that year to just grow at this insane clip. And that almost like bankrupt them, basically. I mean, what happened during 2021 at True Classic Tees?
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you said. I think that think about the moment, right? This is e-commerce is up and to the right. If you're selling anything online, it's doing well. 2021, the interest rate, the funding or things are starting to slow down. So that doesn't really impact them because they haven't fundraised and they're you know, operating a profitable business. But effectively, it came down to not really having realistic expectations and not having a well-defined S&OP process. Ryan defines their process as basically, you know, the co-founders would sit around a table and just be like, hey, you know, like, wouldn't it be cool if we could do $20 million a month? That sounds fun. Let's do that. And so they said, great, let's order in order to do that. And there really wasn't that sophistication to say, all right, what is that going to look like? What are the buyers going to do? What's that going to do our cash position? What happens if maybe it doesn't go forward? What makes us think that 20 million is the right number? Why isn't it 15 versus 25? And so there's all these things that they went through that, as you said, almost killed the company that luckily they made it through. And it was really a formative piece because when you look at True Classic kind of before this experience and after this experience, I think going through this and almost dying and almost losing your business that was doing, you know, $90 million in revenue, that is going to cause you to change some things. And it's going to cause you to really double down and try to make sure you're running this because you know that it can be gone in an instant.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, they were also during that time trying to offload a lot of inventory to turn inventory into cash. A lifeline came from Wayflyer. I don't know the exact terms of that deal, but it seems like that debt provider made, you know, over $1 million off them just kind of in fees to kind of be their lifeline and potentially a percentage of future revenue. I mean, I'm curious, Aaron, how would you set up like your forecasting or demand planning team when, you know, it comes to operating a business like True Classic Tees, right? Like, let's say you're the, you know, chief supply chain officer at True Classic, you're going through this growth period, you know, how would you have set up that demand planning or forecasting team?
Yeah, I'm a fan of keeping things very simple and very basic, and at least from a foundational level so you can understand it. At the end of the day, S&OP planning is comparing what you want to have happen with what you think is going to happen. And then you compare what actually happened with those two. And so I think that, you know, you have to have this framework in place where your goals are what you want to have happen. That is the $20 million a month. And so then you think, okay, what do we think is going to happen? And we want 20 million, but, you know, we're averaging about 8. So do we think it's going to be 10? Do we think it's going to be 12? They still grew in that year that they went through. But at the end of the day, all demand forecasting is traffic times conversion equals sales. And so when I would break this down, I'd say, okay, what is the traffic coming to the website? How much is that organic? How much of that is paid? What is our CAC? What is our budget that we're able to spend toward digital marketing? And so if I know that I'm spending, I'm making this up, but $50 per customer, and I'm willing to spend $5,000 a day, well, I should in theory be acquiring that many customers, right? And so you just kind of break this down into those bits and pieces, because it's all about inputs and outputs. And so, you know, from a teamwork perspective, I don't think you need a super big team, but you need people who are going to be rooted in data and are going to be thinking about this and consistently, you know, being a break a little bit on the company, so that you hear the ambitions of 20 million, but that you also look at the reality and say, you know, in order for that to happen, we're going to have to be willing to be unprofitable, right? Because we're going to have to acquire customers, not at $50, but at $200 in order to get that growth that's there. And that's going to start forcing some good tension, some good conflict in the organization. And you'll start to flesh out the bad ideas faster, and they won't be as dramatic.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, this also was the year, too, that they recruited Ben. I think you pronounce it Ben Alom. It's like Shalom, but with a Y-A-H before. So Ben Alom, I think is how you say it. But he served in the Israeli Air Force. He took on a few initial roles consulting and in data analytics before finding his way to Meta, where she was actually the account rep for True Classic Tees at Meta before he joined True Classic Tees as their president. So I don't know if he's like officially like a fourth co-founder per se, but he now is True Classic Tee president. And he was, you know, basically handling Meta's biggest, you know, spending accounts from an account rep perspective, and, you know, was initially a consultant for True Classic Tees. I think this is like a really strategic hire for the True Classic team, because, you know, if you think about it, like some of the best ways to hire is to kind of first work with them as a consultant or as an advisor and then see your working relationship and then be able to bring them on full time. So, you know, Ben officially joined full time in 2022. But it sounds like he really introduced like structure and rigor to True Classic, and, you know, bringing strong talent too from across, you know, the Meta ecosystem, because he was so plugged in with different brands and understanding best practices. I mean, 2022, True Classic goes on to have a huge year. They reported about $150 million in revenue and expanded to, you know, the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and eventually 190 total countries. Do you know what that expansion looked like in 2022 when they kind of moved internationally to these other countries? You know, did they have different fulfillment centers over there? Or what did that expansion like look like?
No, it was a, you know, US warehouse or Mexican warehouse and just shipping overseas. So it was more of a marketing expansion, as well as dealing with all the customs compliance and things like that. And that's what they do with most of them. They I don't know if they probably have a warehouse in Europe or elsewhere at this point. But most of what they were looking at was just a US company shipping overseas. I kind of want to go back to Ben. I've had a chance to meet him and listen to him to speak. He's incredibly sharp and he's very interesting. And just this idea of who is a founder. And I'm curious of your perspective. What makes somebody a co-founder? Is it someone who's just there at the beginning? Or is it someone who really bends the trajectory of the business? Because I feel like if anybody else deserves to be named as a founder or co-founder at True Classic, Ben would probably be the one.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think a co-founder is someone that starts the business, you know, and joins kind of day one or around day one, right? So, I mean, I don't know Ben personally, and it seems like he's had a lot of impact on True Classic, you know, just from our research. But to me, I think a founder at its core is someone that joined the business, you know, from day one. I think you can still have that founder mentality without necessarily being called, you know, a co-founder. So that's my perspective. I mean, it could probably be debated. I mean, you know, some people could probably say, well, it's a threshold of equity that you own in the business or something of that nature. But, you know, to me, a true founder is someone that, you know, was actually there starting the business.
That's interesting. I think I have a slightly different take on it because, you know, I've known folks that were there for the first 2 months, right? And then they left the business. And so are they a co-founder? Well, their LinkedIn profile says they are, but I wouldn't argue that they were. In my opinion, yeah, I think that the equity threshold is probably an important piece. But I also think that it really comes down to who has an outsized impact on that company. And, you know, I have done this with some of my companies in the past where I've given co-founder title status to folks several years after it started. Because, you know, if I'm here and I want to go here and I can, you know, add someone in to make that difference, then in my opinion, they're kind of a co-founder. You know, I was spending 18 months, 2 years before working it out, trying to get it ready for them. But then at the same time, they have to earn that co-founder status. And so in my kind of estimation, you know, yes, you have to own a significant part of the company, but you really have to be able to show a massive impact. And I think that, I don't know, maybe it's just a little bit more fluid in my mind for what makes or isn't a co-founder.
Yeah, that's good insight too. I think it can be debated, you know, either way. And I think it's, you know, really, I think how you want to incentivize your team and potentially, you know, share ownership and upside with your team, right? So I think it's can be looked at either way. I'm curious though. So 2022, they break out to about $150 million in revenue. What does that like look like broken down? I mean, what kind of looks like, you know, behind the numbers in terms of, you know, estimated gross profit, you know, how much are they spending on ads? What do you think that looks like?
Yeah, so they actually revealed quite a bit in a couple of news sources. So 150 million top line, it was estimated their gross profit was about 105 million. So it's a 70 to 80% margin. So COGS, all that stuff was the 45 million. Shipping was about 22.5 million. They spent $57 million in advertising, which meant that their OPEX, so their salaries, their overheads or infrastructure was about 25 million. And so they had an EBIT of $4.5 million in 2022, which again, I think this is really not only because of their growth, but really this is when they were coming into really the vogue, their heyday from a Twitter perspective, where everybody's just learning about profitability in the startup ecosystem. And here these guys are with a massive business doing pretty much everything right that you could look at. And they're returning, you know, $4.5 million in EBIT that goes back to shareholders or in their case goes back to the business. They didn't stop. In 2023, they were $207 million, which, you know, beginning of the year, they were expecting to be about a $250 million run rate. So still some very healthy growth, but not a whole lot. You know, as you mentioned, in 2022, they had expanded into retail. They had expanded into activewear. They were, you know, they're doing about 2 million orders, 1 million customers. In 2023, they expanded further into dresswear and wovens. Their EBITDA margin or their EBITDA soared to $19 million. And this is when they started to open their first three retail stores as well. And it was reported in 2023 that they spent about $100,000 a day on Meta. And they're donating about 40,000 shirts per month through some different charities that they're working with. But $100,000 on Meta, that's quite a bit.
Yeah, that is. But I mean, compared to Temu that we covered like 2 weeks ago, I mean, Temu is spending, what, $1 billion a year on Meta. So this is a small fraction of that. So, you know, I think they're still sounds like one of the top spenders on Meta from a kind of D2C e-commerce perspective. But, you know, from a macro perspective of spend on Meta, that still is a small sliver compared to, you know, the Temus or Sheins of the world, I would say. And so then in 2024, they're expected to launch a women's line in Q2. Their goal is to have kind of the same feel as Lulu or Vuori, but to be, you know, potentially a lot less. And it seems like, too, they hired the investment bankers at Moelis, is that how you pronounce it? M-O-E-L-I-S, to kind of prepare a pitch to potential acquirers. They're seeking $1 billion valuation, which is incredible. I mean, in this market, I don't know if they'd be able to get that. But, you know, as Ryan says, we're not in a rush. It's really got to be the right partner. It's not just about the right check. You know, I'm curious, what do you think about that valuation in this market? Are they going to, you know, sell for $1 billion or be able to raise capital at $1 billion valuation?
Well, they've been valued at $700 million privately in the past. I think that's just all secondary sale because they haven't raised any venture money. You know, I think they could get the valuation. I don't know if we'll get the acquisition at $1 billion. That's one heck of an EBIT multiple, right? In order to do $20 million in EBIT and be looking for $1 billion valuation. But, you know, they're doing $200 million now. They grow that to $300, $400 million. From a revenue multiple, it's kind of right on track. So I think that maybe not this year, but potentially 2025, they could certainly exit about that amount if that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah, one key question that I have with all these brands is, so, like, you know, we reported that they were spending about $100,000 a day on Meta. What would you think happens to their business if they just turn off their ad spend, right? Like, do you think that their revenue would decline by, you know, 25% and their profit would grow by, you know, 300%? Or, like, what do you think that actually looks like behind these brands, right? Because I'm not saying that you're turning off email marketing. I'm not saying that you're turning off SMS. I'm just saying that you're turning off your ad spend, right? Like, I'm just curious, what do you think would happen to a brand like True Classic when they turn off, you know, if they were to turn off their ad spend on Meta?
You know, you're probably right short term that their profit goes up, their sales go down, predominantly in the fact of just new customer acquisition. But they have built such a database, and we'll get to it here in a moment, but such a database of emails and SMS numbers that they have a very long runway where if for whatever reason Meta and Google were shut down and you could no longer advertise, they'd be okay for a long time. I think it would be much more difficult if they were, you know, in a more competitive category. I mean, it's hard to say that apparel isn't competitive, but they've really started to build out this niche in the premium kind of loungewear or t-shirt, denim. They do so many things now, it's hard to pinpoint them. But they've got a lot of momentum that they could coast for a little while if they wanted to.
Yeah, it makes sense. Let's talk about their outsourcing strategy. So they have a famously, like, lean team. It's reported they have less than 100 employees, including retail. While, you know, most brands their size would have, like, I don't know, maybe 10x the amount of people, right? So, I mean, I'm curious, what does that breakdown look like? How do they stay so lean? You know, how do you think they're able to operate, you know, at this scale with such a lean team?
Yeah, the framework that they talked about is that whenever they encounter a problem that they can't solve themselves, they first look for a tech solution, right? So it's zero people at all, but just, is there someone who has a piece of software we can pay for that will make my pain go away? The second is, if it doesn't exist, then they're going to look for an agency or a vendor to solve that problem. And then third, if they've exhausted those two options, then they'll look to hire someone full time. And so they've done a really good job of sticking to that framework and just being disciplined about, you know, what it is. And it's, you know, it's easier to fire software providers and consultants than it is to hire someone full time or to fire someone full time. And so that's just kind of how they've done it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty amazing approach. And I think their marketing strategy is really showcases how they're able to maintain profitability as they've grown. I think kind of Ben, you know, coined this term in terms of optimizing for contribution profit as the most important metric to orient a brand around. You know, most people in online advertising when it comes to e-commerce just look at ROAS, return on ad spend. But, you know, kind of Ben's basic philosophy was to make sure, number one, that you're always break even on the first order. So they're able to kind of scale for free because they're, you know, breaking even on a first order basis and maintaining, you know, profitability or growing profitability on repeat orders. And they look at, you know, customer email addresses and SMS as kind of assets on their balance sheet, which is pretty amazing. So I guess if you look at the math, you know, their ROAS divided by ad spend is their sales divided by ad spend is typically, you know, obviously what equals ROAS. But they wanted to really understand what their kind of contribution profit was there. So I think what this looks like from a kind of broken down standpoint is they're basically taking kind of their contribution profit out of a sale and dividing that by ad spend to get kind of the net contribution return on ad spend rather than just straight, you know, ad spend, which makes sense, right? Because if I'm selling a $100 t-shirt and I'm spending, you know, $25 to acquire that customer, well, I could say, oh, I'm got a 4x ROAS, but it cost me, you know, $10 to produce that shirt. It cost me another $5 to ship it. It cost me, you know, X amount of dollars on tax and whatever else, you know, may add up to get that order to my end customer. And so I think Ben's philosophy around this, you know, is just amazing. I mean, that goes to show how strong he is as an operator to kind of, you know, really focus on the contribution profit.
Yeah. And I think the insight here and probably why 2022 was such a rocket ship year is their philosophy is really, I want to be break even from a contribution profit perspective on my first customer. And so they're looking at this and saying, all right, every email that I get from someone, every phone number that I get, that is an asset that I should keep on my balance sheet because I can target them indefinitely forever. And so I want to get those for free. And so they're willing to spend as aggressively as they can so that they're not losing money in that first order. And in the hopes that the profits will come later on. So it's a really interesting piece there. And the thought is that, you know, they're at break even, they're spending as much as they can afford to without losing money. And then they're looking for these creative breakthroughs or these technological breakthroughs that will suddenly allow their marketing dollars to go farther or allow them to lower their costs so they can accelerate their growth that way.
Yeah, I noticed too, as I analyzed their ads, like they have so much content behind them. I'm curious, like, do you know how much of that is in-house? How do they generate, you know, more content? I mean, that was really impressive when I looked at their ads.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the unique things is despite their stated goal to not have employees or to have fewer employees than one might think, they do about 80% of their content creation in-house. And so they do this because it helps them be faster, nimbler. It does help lower some costs, but rather than being 100%, they are still working with agencies for the other 20%. And they think that that balance is a good mix so that they still get the fresh ideas. I mean, the downside of using an agency is that your best ideas go to your competitors, right? Because they're just going to recycle those ideas with their clients. But then the benefit of using an agency is all of your competitors' best ideas make it back to you as well. And so I think that's an interesting piece to look at, making sure you get the exposure to that ecosystem without being stuck. And so broadly speaking, from a creative perspective, they think about in four buckets. You know, they do 25% comedy, 25% user-generated content. Another quarter will be informative or edutainment stuff. And then, you know, the other 25% will be kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. And as you mentioned, they're running hundreds of ads at a time. And this is allowing them to test. These are the kind of those breakthroughs they look at. And it's just the scale is quite impressive.
Yeah, it's incredible what they do from a content perspective. That's for sure. I think too, like, you know, one article that I saw really honed in on their approach to customer service and customer experience. It seems like their VP of customer experience, Brenna Moreno, has really brought a lot of insight to their CX team, right? So they look at the full customer journey in terms of, you know, support agents having a comprehensive view of each customer's history, you know, what they've ordered, you know, their repeat order rate, all that important data. They have seamless customer interactions. So they try to, you know, eliminate repetitive customer tasks, really try to optimize their CX experience. They also include humor, which I think is fun, you know, for the brand and their CX strategy. And they take a data-driven approach to, you know, regularly understanding feedback from customers, trying to pinpoint, you know, how customers first heard of them, you know, all that stuff I think is important to creating this holistic brand that True Classic has grown. I'm curious, you know, from a retail perspective, what does, you know, retail strategy and engagement look like at True Classic?
Yeah, so I think despite being a successful D2C company, the reality is that 65% of all retail is still bought in person. People want to touch the fabric. They want to be able to try it on in the store. And so if they were going to continue to grow, they had to get into retail. So they initially partnered with this company called Leap. I don't know if you know them, but they're basically a network of pop-up stores that brands can test into. So if I want to test a retail location in Soho, I can sign a lease for 2 months, 3 months, whatever it's going to be. And they'll help operate that. And so they partnered with Leap with their first store in November of 22. And they grew that to, I think, 5 stores by the end of 2023. And this was something that they decided to insource in 2023, ultimately because they were looking for more control. And they wanted to just make the stores look a little bit better than kind of a recycled pop-up space. And so they brought in Brett Paulson, who's their VP of retail. And he previously worked at UNTUCKit, where he had opened 80 stores. So talk about going out and finding somebody who, you know, was purpose-built for what you needed. And just the timing here that was interesting is he started in March of 23, and they opened their first Houston store in October of 23. And so, you know, you kind of figure out like, okay, how long is it going to take to go from nothing to retail? You know, about that long, about 7 months. And the kind of true to form or true classic, they have made profitability of these retail stores a very important understanding and metric. And so every store needs to perform, otherwise they'll shut them down. And they've talked about opening hundreds of stores, but it's really going to be predicated on, are these stores profitable or not?
Yeah, Brent got to work. I mean, that's a pretty quick turnaround from, you know, starting in March to opening their first store in October. Hats off to him and his execution there. I mean, that's awesome. I think, too, it's important because I think a lot of e-commerce brands look at like blended ROAS, right? And look across, you know, the board. And I think, you know, really what sets True Classic apart in terms of their strategy is they hone in on profitability, or not just profitability, but like their, you know, contribution profit from a ROAS perspective for each channel, which is awesome. I mean, that's a huge takeaway, I think, in terms of their strategy.
Yeah. Who'd have thought that like businesses should make money?
Yeah. Well, in this market, that's definitely number one. That's for sure. Their purchase experience too also stood out because if you go on their site and you give them, you know, your email and cell phone, you get $20 as a discount on your first order, which is awesome.
This was such an interesting thing because I actually did a test order, and so I just want to walk through kind of my experience because it was probably the best like e-commerce experience that I've had as a consumer, just with how well orchestrated it was. And so I want to walk through that and then kind of compare that with some of the fulfillment pieces that I saw as I ducked into it. And so, as you were mentioning, you know, once you sign up, they give you a $20 discount if you turn over your email and your cell phone. And again, the thought here is that that email, that cell phone number, that is an asset that goes in their balance sheet. They're going to be able to email. They have that first party data. Like, it's so valuable, so they're willing to spend $20 just to get that. But the interesting way they do it is I'm used to, you know, you sign up and then you get a little coupon code and it gets applied to your order. But what they do is they're using an app called Fondue. And basically what that does is it guarantees you cash back. And so the idea is that you're going to pay full price for the product initially, but after the return window, you have the opportunity of getting your $20 back in a Visa card or getting $36 back in store credit. So it's like, it's a really interesting thing that I hadn't quite experienced myself. And so, you know, that was like the first initial piece on the website. And then when you go to checkout, there's a 5-minute window when you could add more things to that order. And so, you know, there's like a countdown that's going through and they just start throwing discounts for other similar products that would go well. And so I ordered some t-shirts and they're like, hey, have you seen our pants? Which is like, these shirts, what about this? You know, these sorts of things. And you have to physically go through and click decline offer to move off of that screen. And when you click decline offer, it gives you a whole nother slew of discounts and things to look at. And then I had to click it again before I went to a new landing page. And that new landing page was actually talking about the referral program and saying, hey, thanks for buying from us. You know, you can earn $25 for each referral. Here's your custom code. Why not send it out? And so it was very interesting kind of how they had structured that whole thing. And, you know, I placed my order, but then they didn't miss an opportunity to try to throw more stuff at me and then to also try to increase the, you know, other people coming in from a referral point of view, even though I hadn't physically touched the product.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see that implementation. I mean, I know Fondue was bought by Postscript late last year. And so, you know, Alex and the team at Postscript, I think, have done an incredible job with their merchants that use Postscript, integrating that whole experience into their SMS strategy to provide, you know, this cashback offer to you know, customers like yourself when shopping on True Classic Tees. So it is a pretty incredible experience that I think drives retention, you know, drives profitability. And on Fondue, it's a pretty cool tool. You can really, you know, adjust the parameters around when you want to offer cash back. And they have a lot of really fully integrated features to hone in on, you know, what's the best offer to provide your customers to, you know, increase AOV.
Yeah. I also thought, like, post order, that their welcome series was really well done as well. So rather than just saying, hey, thanks for your order, we'll see you later, they had a call to action. And effectively it was, here are four things that you can do while you're waiting for your package. And they talked about how I could pay $1 a month, I could pay $12 a year to join their Insiders Club. So it's kind of this play on Amazon Prime where, hey, I put $1 in each month, and so I better purchase from there. But that Insiders Club gets you 20% back on every order, a limited free shipping. You get to join a community. There's surprises, gifts, things like that. So that was like objective number one they could do. Then they went back to the referral code and, you know, try to make that easy. Encouraged me to follow them on Instagram. That was number three. And then they actually have a phone app, like an actual app. And so they encouraged me to download the True Classic app for kind of easier shopping trips next time I need t-shirts. And so it was really interesting, just I think all of the foresight and the thought that had gone into that customer experience was really good. And then, you know, we kind of juxtaposed that with the supply chain, and their supply chain is very good, but there were a couple of things that kind of stuck out, and particularly on the fulfillment side. Before I do that, do you want to just jump in and talk a little bit about factories?
Yeah. I also too want to talk about their Insider Club. So I've seen a lot of brands roll this out, and it's a way for them to improve cash flow drastically and improve customer loyalty. This is actually what, you know, is the back end behind their Insiders Club, is run by a software company called Inveterate that was founded by Dylan Whitman. And Dylan Whitman used to run Brand Value Accelerator, which was one of the biggest Shopify Plus agencies at the time, working with, you know, top brands like Movement Watches. And so there's been a lot of brands rolling out these kind of like insider clubs. And the goal really is to, you know, really increase cash flow for the brand, to manage their cash more effectively with this club and increase customer loyalty. And it's been proven to do that drastically. You know, it's almost like creating like your own, you know, Delta Sky Miles program, but, you know, specifically for your brand, which is pretty awesome. And so they do a really good job around this. I think it really increases their customer loyalty. And I think it's, you know, just another great software vendor that e-commerce brands are utilizing to, you know, improve their cash flow and improve their customer loyalty and increase AOV.
How big do you think a brand needs to be, either in revenue or in orders? Or is it more of an email list sort of thing? Like, how big do you have to be for that sort of thing to make sense?
You know, I think it can be a varying level. You know, I've seen like low to mid seven figure brands implement this, as well as, you know, multi-$100 million a year brands. So I don't know if brand size really necessarily matters to implement this. I think, you know, it just really is a great way to increase customer loyalty. And like for $12 a year, like you're gaining some cash from the customer, which is awesome, but you're also really at the end of the day increasing, you know, their lifetime value, which is really the end goal. So I think it's, you know, a great approach that these brands are taking. And, you know, I've seen it play out really well for brands to, you know, just create more loyalty there. From the app perspective, I've seen a lot of brands roll out their own mobile apps. And so I'm just kind of curious, like, you know, what their conversion is from having their own native app, because I don't know how effective that is compared to like creating something really natively on your website, right? So it's something that I've, you know, just been interested to see. I don't know the exact numbers behind, you know, an Insiders Club or a brand's own app, but, you know, I think it really is well implemented by True Classic Tees, and, you know, their goal is to increase lifetime value. That's for sure with both of those tools. So, I mean, that's my take on their Insiders Club and app. In terms of their supply chain, I mean, it looks like True Classic partners with 10 manufacturing plants across Egypt, Turkey, China, and Bangladesh. They're really focused on shortening their lead times and protecting, you know, against holding too much inventory. But they really, you know, have tried to become more transparent in regards to forecasting. You know, we saw some of their factories on Import Genius and on Panjiva. So, you know, if you just Google like True Classic Tees, Import Genius, you can see some of their factories. But, you know, I think their factory base is pretty strong. They're definitely not single source. They're working with a multitude of vendors across countries, which is a really strong sourcing and supply chain, you know, just place to be. And so I really think they're doing a strong job when it comes to their factory base. And I think, you know, probably one of the key questions that I would bring up is their cash conversion cycle in terms of, you know, what kind of terms are they able to get with their suppliers? Because cash conversion cycle with any business, especially in e-commerce, is such a key. And so I've been really curious to see, you know, what does their cash conversion cycle look like? Do you think they're getting a lot of you know, terms from their suppliers?
So they say that they produce with about 10 different manufacturing partners across Egypt, Turkey, China, and Bangladesh. When I dig into the data, it looks like they're heavily weighted toward China as their predominant manufacturing partner. And they have implemented some interesting strategies to help mitigate the lead time and mitigate some of the tax implications that are there. The first is that they're holding raw materials with their factories. And so this allows them to have already dyed fabric that's ready to go so that rather than a lead time being maybe 90 days, it is 30 days. That makes them have to wait for that fabric to be produced, dyed, things like that. It's really just the cut and sew operation. So that's a, you know, theory that's been implemented pretty well. You have to have some scale to be able to do that. But then the other thing that they do is they're big proponents of the 3-2-1 loophole with fulfillment. And so going back to kind of my experience with ordering, I ordered my product on a Friday, and I was actually quite surprised. It was fulfilled on a Saturday. And I was like, wow, this is great. And then I think it was probably something more where that was when the order was accepted and was produced. I don't know if it was actually shipped out. But it was very clear that it was being done outside the United States and Mexico. Because the first hit that I got with DHL e-commerce was that it had crossed in McClellan, Texas. Initially, I thought maybe this was just, you know, they're sourcing from Tijuana and that's just where their broker was. But the product showed up in Houston as the first kind of transit point. And, you know, it's been about 7-8 days at this point, and the product still isn't here yet. It's kind of, I think last I checked, it was in Raleigh. I'm supposed to get it over the weekend on Monday. And so it was just a little bit interesting that, you know, despite this really great, awesome experience on the front with all of these sorts of things that they were able to do to really make a big impression on me from a buying perspective, that they've had the calculus that, you know, perhaps slower orders is worthwhile. And I imagine it's probably something where perhaps the idea is that they're going to save some of that profit, some of that margin, and they'd rather spend more on marketing. And, you know, most people aren't going to do a podcast and look at their supply chain, look at the shipping speeds, and that's probably okay. And so that's probably the calculus that went into it. But I was actually talking with a friend, a CEO who runs a company in a similar space. They sell jeans. And he had mentioned that they were doing some studies about the impact of spending more on shipping on LTV. He talked about how that has a pretty big impact on LTV. It's a pretty big impact on the speed to the second purchase. And so there's some thoughts there about, you know, obviously you want to balance things between being very, very cost effective and kind of going slow as possible versus speed and looking at that. And so I wonder if there's a minor tweak here for True Classic where perhaps on their first orders, the first customers net new, maybe we look at using a DHL Max sort of product, which would be a 2-3 day transit. Even if it's international, versus doing DHL Ground, which is going to be a, you know, 8 to 10 day sort of piece.
I think their section 3-2-1 setup, you know, that really devalues their first customer experience, right? Because they're, you know, taking so long to get that first shirt or product to you, and that's devaluing their customer experience. They just spent so much time and effort building up with you, right? In terms of that, you know, first purchase experience. And so I agree with you. I think they need to make that at least first order shipping time faster. You know, maybe their repeat orders could be a bit slower, but at the same time, you know, I think taking a week or longer to get a product in today's market is unacceptable for most customers. So, I mean, do you think they're just saving a ton of money by, you know, utilizing ground shipment and kind of utilizing section 3-2-1? Or, you know, what do you think is really the real decision here? I mean, they must have looked at, you know, LTV versus ship time, I would assume.
Oh, for sure. I mean, because of where they're sourcing from, they have to, in order to keep growing the way they're going to, they have to have a fulfillment center outside the U.S. I mean, otherwise their costs go up by 25% overnight just by virtue of having it here in the U.S. And so, like, that is just one reality of the decisions that they've built their company around from an operational perspective. Obviously, you know, shifting more of that production to Vietnam, Morocco, elsewhere will mitigate that. But clearly what I purchased came from Asia, which is why it was being sourced from there. I also think that there's nothing wrong with choosing ground shipping. There's nothing wrong with having slower shipping, but it felt like it was a different level of brand experience than I was expecting. Because, you know, if I purchase a product, I'm going to spend $100 on it. I kind of, you know, would prefer to have it quicker, or, you know, maybe let me know that ahead of time. And, you know, just the fact that, like, everything was so much of a, hey, you ordered, here's four or five other things we want you to do before you've even seen the product. Like, I was gung-ho, and I'm like, hey, I want to keep doing this. And then you find, like, oh, it's going to be a while. And so, again, that could be a very intentional decision where they want to build the anticipation and they want you to do different things while you're waiting. But it just felt a little bit odd to me. And again, not wrong, not bad, just
yeah,
odd.
I agree. I mean, I think too, it's interesting to see how this would reflect on their, like, international strategy as well. I mean, I think eventually they probably have to have some fulfillment presence, you know, overseas, especially as they expand internationally. I mean, I'm curious, how have you seen brands navigate that at this scale, you know, in terms of, you know, growing so much in America? I think it was reported that they do like 20 to 30% of their sales, you know, internationally. At what point should a brand like this open a 3PL, you know, in Europe or Australia or wherever, you know, their main customers are overseas?
Yeah, it comes down to, one, do you have the volume to justify it? And based on my back of the envelope math, they're probably doing anywhere from 190 to 210,000 shipments a month. So let's call it 200. So that's like a lot of volume. Now, the second piece of that is, once you have the volume, the question is, do you have the density and what kind of experience are you trying to build? If I don't necessarily care about being quick to the consumer, or if I don't necessarily care about localization, then I might as well just keep my inventory in one spot and fulfill internationally from a single place, and just know that, you know, a customer ordering in Australia or Austria is going to wait 10 to 14 days. And that just may be a decision that's made. And if that consumer knows that they are buying from an American company, then that's it. That's kind of built in. But if they try to pass themselves off as a French company or a Swedish company, or at least that type of consumer, then those consumers are probably going to be expecting something a little bit faster than maybe what I experienced.
Yeah, that's a good insight. I think too, what I wish I could learn that I wasn't able to uncover in their supply chain and factory base was around their terms with their factories, right? Because I think that reflects a lot on their ability to grow in terms of their cash conversion cycle. So I just wonder what kind of terms they have with their factories. You know, they have a very vast factory network, and I'm curious, like, how they navigated negotiating those terms, especially as they were scaling at such a fast clip. I mean, like, what do you think their terms are right now, if you were to estimate, and how would you even go about, you know, negotiating terms like this as you're growing at such a fast clip?
Yeah, I think there's two things that go into it. Well, to answer your question directly, I think they're probably like a net 30 to net 45, maybe net 60 sort of piece. But there's two things that come into it. The first one is, what is the velocity that's going through? A net 90 term is different if you're ordering once a year versus ordering every 2 weeks, right? Because you have this cash that's coming in that's just, it's working and it's going through there. So that's like the first piece that I would look at. The other piece is obviously just the volume and the density that's coming. And so if they are able to partner with the factory and maybe they are putting a deposit down and saying, hey, I'm going to give you $1 million. That's working capital for all of our fabric. We expect to not have any lead time, you know, related to fabric. And therefore, you know, we will just want to focus on getting this turned as quickly as we can. You start to do things where maybe there's a dedicated line, there's a dedicated shift, there's dedicated people that allow you to work in it. And so you can always trade profit for cash, for terms. And so depending on where they are on that journey, they may decide that they want to. But for a younger company that has aspirations of wanting to be True Classic, I would 100% encourage them to take a lower margin if that meant they get better terms. Because that's just, you use them as your balance sheet, as their bank.
Yeah, and you start makes to a lot of out. Sense. This story has been awesome. I mean, True Classic Tees is just such an amazing business. Their supply chain is very robust. I mean, I am surprised by their fulfillment strategy, I would say. I think I agree with you. It devalues that customer experience a lot. That's probably kind of the only thing that I would really change, you know, if I were to join their supply chain team in some sense. But I think their sourcing strategy is strong. Their marketing strategy is just incredible and top notch. And it's cool to see how they have that loyalty program built in. I'm curious, what are your takeaways from True Classic Tees?
They are doing so many things right. And I think that it is hard to kind of nitpick and look at these sorts of things, but they are doing well. And this is why they're aspirational for so many other founders. I think that, you know, these radical ideas of understanding your costs, this radical notion of making a profit, and this radical notion of, hey, maybe we should really collect these emails and SMSs and use them for, you know, down the road. That is really, those are kind of basic in retrospect, but they've been so revolutionary to people that are used to a zero interest rate VC treadmill where they're just going to spend and kind of see where they are.
The environment's changed. And I think we'll see pretty soon here, you know, this year or next year, in regards to, does True Classic Tees get that, you know, $1 billion valuation that they were aiming for and that they hired that investment banker to help them with. What a story, what a journey. This episode of E-commerce on Tap has been amazing, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. Please like, share, leave a comment, and find Aaron and I on LinkedIn or Twitter.